This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. Let's start 2026 with a hard truth. There's no perfect time to build the future you secretly dream of, and there's no time to waste. With support from a Talkspace therapist, you can make this the year you bravely go out and grab what you need from life, whether that's outer rewards or inner peace. Just go to Talkspace.com to be matched with a licensed online therapist. You can start messaging with your therapist right away and schedule live virtual sessions over video, audio, or chat. Your Talkspace therapist can help you create personalized strategies for making the changes and achieving the goals most important to you. Talkspace accepts most insurance with an average copay of $15, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80. That's SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome to the Forging Wellness Podcast, where we go beyond the basics of health and wellness to build stronger minds, bodies, and communities. I'm your host, Jesse Clark, a firefighter, paramedic, and coach with 19 years as a first responder. I have a passion for this job, for my family, and for truly enjoying life. But I'll be the first to admit I haven't always gotten it right. Had my ups and downs, made mistakes, and learned some lessons the hard way. But that's what this podcast is all about. Learning, growing, and forging a better path together. We're diving into mental and physical health, fitness, nutrition, sleep, leadership, real-world challenges, history, and what it truly takes to thrive. Whether you're a current first responder, aspiring to be one, retired, or the spouse of one, this is for you. Life is more than just making it through the day. Let's forge ahead together. Now let's get into it. Hello, and welcome back to Forging Wellness Podcast. My name is Jesse Clark, and today we have with us Dr. Brooke Bartlett. She has done a bunch of podcasts. You've written a bunch of articles. Hopefully, we're going to talk about all those things, and we're just going to have fun with this episode, just real informal conversation. But to introduce you, you basically spend a lot of time with trauma culture within the first responder space, and you kind of address it with personality, honesty, and humor. So we want to dive into your trauma expertise, but also talk to somebody who deeply understands this job and knows how to laugh about it and isn't afraid to call out the system when it needs called out.
Sure.
So Brooke, why don't you give us a little introduction to yourself and we'll go from there.
Well, thanks for having me on, Jesse. As Jesse said, I'm Brooke Bartlett. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist, and specifically I'm a first responder and military psychologist. So my entire background, all my training is specifically working with military and first responders. So I've done, you know, I kind of have my hands in a lot of different places in terms of doing the clinical work, the therapy side of things, and the research related to trauma and all things trauma and first responders and military, and also just being kind of boots on the ground type stuff, you know, working in departments, you know, responding on scene, doing peer support programming, doing all those different things. So every day looks different for me, which is what I love, because I think I'd go a little bit crazy being just the same thing 9 to 5 every day.
Okay. So with every day looking different for you, my very first question for you is, could you name a song that describes your work week?
Probably Angel of Death by Slayer, I would say.
Okay.
All right. At least the intro to it, you know? Yeah. Okay.
I like it. So, and obviously we've got to follow HIPAA guidelines and everything here. No names. What's the weirdest thing that you have ever heard in therapy, in your opinion? Because obviously that's different for everybody.
It's a really good question. Let's see. I'm trying to think about the weirdest thing I've ever heard in therapy. I guess this isn't too crazy, but one thing that's popping to mind is someone that would just drive to an airport and stand under the airport and watch like planes fly over was a very soothing thing for them. It was soothing for them, but you know, that was a first for me of like, I like to just go drive to the airport and stand right underneath the flight path and like spend hours there just watching planes fly directly over me. So that was interesting. There's a lot of other weird things I've heard that probably aren't super appropriate to talk about here, but I'll keep it.
Okay. I mean, we're pretty open book here, so we can pretty much say whatever we want, but I like it. I mean, and it weird for you. Also, I would say weird for me, but for that person, for each individual. It's not weird. It's what works for them. Like you said, something that's calming or soothing for that person. And at least they found that. So I love that. That, I mean,
yeah. Hearing a jet fly over me and the sound and everything certainly wouldn't calm me, but hey, to each their own, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so that's a warm up for this episode. Those are the type of things we're going to be getting into a little bit. But let's go into trauma and let's try and make it relatable. So you wrote one article that specifically talked about how trauma affects the brain. So in firefighter speak, explain to the probie or the new guy version of that.
Yeah. So I like to emphasize to people that our brain is just like any muscle in our body. It's constantly changing. It's constantly adapting. So just because we can't actually see what's going on underneath the surface here, if someone's super hypervigilant, they have post-traumatic stress, all these things going on, it's not just this amorphous thing that if they were just strong enough, they can just get over, right? There's actual changes going on in the brain. And thanks to advances in science, neuroscience, we can actually scan brains and look at these changes, both structural and functional changes in the brain. The good news is it doesn't mean that someone's permanently stuck like that either, because we all are born with a superpower called neuroplasticity, which allows us to change through things, evidence-based therapy. But when we're talking about trauma in the brain, there's three key players of how trauma affects the brain, okay? We have a part of our brain called the prefrontal cortex up here. We have a part of our brain, a structure in our brain called the amygdala. And then we have a structure in our brain called the hippocampus, okay? So the amygdala has one job. It's probably, scientists believe, one of the parts of our brain that has changed the least over thousands of years of, you know, human beings. And it's because it has one job, and that one job is survival. So if it ain't broke, why fix it, right? So that's all it does. Most of the other structures in our brain have multiple jobs. Survival. Okay. So think of the amygdala as our threat center. When the amygdala goes off, it says danger, 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 and sends everything else in our body in response to that threat. Okay. Now, our prefrontal cortex up here has a lot of important functions, things like emotion regulation, logical thinking, impulse control, etc. That's where all this happens, our critical thinking. So that's what differentiates us from other mammals, for example, that can't critically or logically think. It's what we have going on up here in our prefrontal cortex. Okay. The third one would be the hippocampus, which is, think of it as our little memory center. Okay. It's where we learn, store, and retrieve memories. All right. So when we have repeated trauma, or let's just say a major trauma or repeated chronic trauma over time, what starts to happen to each of these structures is that our amygdala learns to start firing over and over and over again, even sometimes when there's no objective threat in front of us. And because our amygdala is objectively has the most important job, which is to keep us alive, when it's on, it's the loudest. So it kind of dims down those other parts of the brain, which is important, right? If we are truly in a life or death situation, I don't want to be thinking critically. I want to just get shit done, right? I need to know what to do so that I can survive, right? But unfortunately, if our amygdala is firing off more than it needs to, then all of a sudden, all these other parts of our brain that have really important functions, like regulating my emotions and helping me learn things and remember things, all those things continue to be dulled down. Okay. So we have this overactive amygdala. We have a prefrontal cortex that the lights are dimmed. And now we have a hippocampus, our memory storage center, where the files are all pulled out all over the place, rearranged, and all these things. So when we talk about post-traumatic stress injury and we think about the symptoms of chronic irritability, kind of rage going up and down, apathy, not being able to think, not being able to remember things, some of the most common symptoms of it. This is what it's tied to. It's actually tied to things that are going on in our brain, not just some amorphous thing that all of a sudden now I'm just getting pissed off all the time.
Okay. So three functions, amygdala, prefrontal cortex, and hippocampus. Amygdala fires real heavy. It gets louder than the rest. Also, I'm going to try and say it. This came up in a recent episode, actually, with a functional medicine doctor, but essentially it can create some short circuits as well, I believe, in the sense that our brain gets used to dealing with things in a certain way and realizes, oh, I might not have to go through this whole process every single time to deal with this type of event. Something specifically that I know about with that is related to fitness. And a way that we can rewire the brain is make sure that we actually take that moment after working out to actually get our bodies to realize that we are in that rest and digest phase, or that we need to go into that phase. So that way the body goes through that full process. Does that sound like a dumbed down version of that?
I totally get what you're saying. I mean, hey, I try and use analogies as much as I can to like compare it to the physical body and things that go on the physical side. I mean, this is still physical, but sometimes it's easier to really grasp and understand when we compare it to physical things. So I think that's a great example. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So moral injury, what is it? And why do you think it might be sneakier than...
So moral injury is basically when we perceive, and I'm going to underline the word perceive, okay? When we perceive that we violated our morals or values in some way. Now, this can happen in a few different ways. One, that we believe that we have actively, like I have actively done something that is violated my morals or my values. Like, let's say I snap at my husband or something, I'm pissed off and I snap at him. I don't feel good about that. I feel guilty. And then I typically apologize. The second way would be the thing that I see most commonly in my first responders would be, I perceive that I violated my morals due to inaction in some way. I should have been there quicker. I should have done this faster. If I had just seen the signs, they would still be here. Those would be examples of things that could also lead to moral injury. So having a crew member or friend die by suicide, like, I should have seen the signs. I should have picked up his call last week. I should have checked in more. I should have pushed harder when I heard that they weren't doing well. And then really, you know, those would be examples of that. The third way would be, you know, if we watch someone engage, like it witness someone violating our values, or someone is doing something to us that is very violating to us. Okay. So it can be a little bit sneakier. So moral injury and post-traumatic stress are not the same thing, but moral injury often occurs in traumatic situations. Okay. Put it this way, like traumatic situations, traumatic events really are a breeding ground for moral injury because, you know, you have a higher likelihood of having, rough outcomes, right? Like, let's say someone dying on scene, or, you know, something bad happening, being in a position where I'm the one who has to like try and take care of this person, try and save this person. There's a lot of different factors in a traumatic incident that really increase the risk for moral injury. So someone could have moral injury outside of a traumatic incident. Like, let's say someone, you know, cheated on their wife or their husband, and they're feeling overwhelming guilt. That would be an actual wrongdoing, but that they're also experiencing moral injury. But what it's important to understand is the moral injury that I most commonly come across in my first responders is when there's guilt, which is typically we feel that in the aftermath of wrongdoing, but there was no actual wrongdoing committed. So someone is really carrying this massive, I just picture this massive backpack of these really heavy bricks of guilt around that just festers and festers, and it starts to come out in other ways that starts to be really deleterious to someone's life. So they are blaming themselves for the death of their friend, or they're blaming themselves that, you know, they couldn't save that victim, or they're blaming themselves, you know, in different ways in a scenario where they objectively did not actually commit any wrongdoing.
Yeah, that can be very challenging. I know this from personal experience. Obviously, I've shared my story with you on that. We won't get into that too much today. But even when you feel good that like, okay, I know in that moment, I did everything that I possibly could. But there's still parts of you that are like, did I though? And you know, for me specifically, replaying that, and when my friend died by suicide, knowing that everything went well, but then as I replayed it, the timeline felt totally different in my mind. And there was question about hesitation. Did I hesitate? Because I've never hesitated before in an emergency situation. So was this time different? Did I mess up? And it took a lot of digging, a lot of work to kind of work through that. Because it seems small almost that like, but it's that little voice that maybe kind of keeps poking at you from the back, right? Does that describe it okay?
Absolutely. And so in your scenario, you're talking about doing some work to kind of, you know, make it so that that didn't kind of like plant itself and fester and grow and grow. And that's where we get to the moral injury that really becomes, frankly, very dangerous for individuals when moral injury becomes very severe. In the aftermath of something like a tragedy like that, it is completely adaptive to think about different ways because we're born to do that. So guilt in and of itself is not a bad emotion. It's pro-socially adaptive. And it's, again, All of this is evolutionarily wired in us. Guilt is not a comfortable feeling, an emotion. So when we feel it, what we try and do is first understand what it is, what did I do wrong, right? And then we want to repair that wrongdoing. And again, if we think about human beings, if you did something wrong and didn't, you know, repair that wrongdoing in some way, you'd be kicked out of the tribe. They don't want you there anymore. And if you're kicked out of the tribe, you're dead. So today, in the modern day, you know, we still feel guilt. So we feel guilt and we typically try to repair the wrongdoing. If I snapped at my husband, I try and repair that. And then it also typically tries to prevent us from doing the same thing again, because that guilt is so uncomfortable. So guilt is an adaptive emotion. It can become maladaptive, though, when it sticks around for extended periods of time, especially when there's objectively no wrongdoing. So analyzing the aftermath of some kind of tragedy like this is an adaptive thing, because we want to think about, is there anything I could have done to prevent this terrible outcome? And how, what can I do in the future to prevent another terrible outcome like this again? So that in and of itself is not bad or abnormal. It's when there's not actually work being done, processing being done, all the things, you know, that you did, so that it's not just continue, the bricks don't continue to just get heavier and heavier, and that backpack continues to get more and more full. That's where we get into of the problematic moral injury.
Something that you said that was interesting to me is there's moral injury when you potentially witness somebody doing something that goes against your values or your moral compass. Mm-hmm. A lot of times that probably gets overlooked and we brush it aside. And I have to imagine it's tough, because in today's society, Hollywood does a really good job of normalizing all things that are immoral. I mean, on everybody's spectrum. And so does it make it hard to even understand that that injury is going on, because sometimes those morals or those values seem to be normalized so much? I mean, and it's not just Hollywood, it happens.
It's a great question. So in a case like that, if there was something, for example, that Hollywood was doing that directly affected you in some way, like your morals and values, right? That kept you from aligning with your morals and values, that could lead to moral injury. Seeing, you know, all the shit that goes on in Hollywood and be like, gross, you know, and like, that's wrong and that's wrong and that's wrong. But, you know, I separate myself from that. That's not moral injury. It would more so be, I'll give you an example. Okay. And this is a friend of mine who, is a retired, you know, former career firefighter, but, at the department he was working at, one of his crew died by suicide that morning. They were a very tight-knit crew. They were all extremely gutted, and they had already had a lot of issues with leadership, and just it was just not a great department per my friend. And basically leadership came in that day, and basically the what was communicated was like, get back to work. And that was it. And he quit the next day. He's like, I just can't do it anymore. Like, that was just so morally wrong to him. And he like couldn't do it. Like, so that would be an example of like someone else's actions that are then leading to that is so morally wrong to us. That would like, if he were to stay there, he would have been like, that would have been so against my morals to just go on and act like my friend is not dead right now and not even have any, like, it was basically like, suck it up. Like, that was the approach to it. And so that would be an example of like someone else's actions directly impeding on me that could lead to moral injury.
Okay. So what's something that you wish that every firehouse knew about trauma recovery that isn't often talked
about? Great question. I wish they knew more about the science behind it, kind of a little bit of the stuff that we talked about already, but that just like any other muscle in our body, even if our muscle is sore, even slightly injured, that there are things that we can do proactively and while it's occurring so that we can keep ourselves as healthy as possible. Like if you have a professional athlete and I told the professional athlete, hey, if you just do these things, you'll never have an injury. You'll never be sore, right? I'd be a kook. It's not realistic, but like approaching it from this idea of like, these are objective scientific things that we can do, because your brain, just like any other muscle in your body that you focus on for physical fitness, is important to keep this, approach this as like physical fitness as well.
Okay. So what are some of the proactive approaches to strengthening that, from simple practical techniques all the way up to, is there technology now that we can utilize to help us know that we are training our brain in that way.
So the most simple but truly scientifically studied effective thing is talking to people. You literally hook people's brains up and there are changes in people's brains and what's actually actively occurring at that time. Talking to people is one of the biggest protective factors against development of severe post-traumatic stress injury. It really is. Because what leads to the development of severe post-traumatic stress injury and post-traumatic stress disorder is avoidance. It's the road that leads to it, and it's what maintains it. It's the heartbeat. Avoidance, avoidance, avoidance. Okay. And one of the ways that a lot of individuals, particularly my first responders in military, that they avoid is they do not speak to other people, you know, about these types of things, right? I'm good, 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 right? And it just snowballs and snowballs and snowballs. So even something as simple as, and that call really sucked, or like, I didn't sleep well last night. I just kept thinking about, you know, whatever it was on that call. That even of itself, opening that conversation, of course, with people you trust, you don't want to just go talking around to people you don't like or that you know are untrustworthy, but talking about these things. And it's just incredible, the phenomenon of seeing what happens when one person is willing to just acknowledge certain things and talk about certain things, and then other people also start to follow suit. It never ceases to amaze me.
Okay. So is there any technology out there that we are finding useful in helping address some of these things or allow us to strengthen that muscle?
That's a good question. What do you mean by technology? Like specifically for the brain or?
Yeah. So something that has come up in a couple podcasts is heart math during mindfulness practice, or I know that there's people out there that are using like neurofeedback.
Yeah. So I was going to say biofeedback, neurofeedback. Those things are really effective. And what those things are is basically it's technology that allows you to not only see what's going on physiologically in your body, but allows you to kind of gain the skill of self-soothing, we can call it, or basically regulating. So for example, getting off shift in general, like if someone notices that they're still pretty amped up and they, man, I can't fall asleep when I get home, that's because you got to be really on guard the entire time you're on shift. That's not particularly abnormal in that sense. But what things like biofeedback and neurofeedback can do is help people develop the skills to regulate, get their sympathetic nervous system down, which is that system that, you know, go, 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 go system, and start to kind of soothe and pump up that parasympathetic nervous system, which is more the rest and digest system. So I would say neurofeedback and biofeedback are two of the most effective things. That goes along with, now keep in mind, I'm gonna put an asterisk on this. And what I always tell is, you know, if someone's at the point where things are really not going well, they have really struggling with post-traumatic stress, or really struggling with anxiety or depression or whatever it is, you know, just doing things like that on their own isn't going to get someone back into the green, right? You need professional help. Evidence-based treatment is not talk therapy. It's very structured. It's a protocol. But in terms of maintaining your health and building what is the catchy word now of resilience, right? But maintaining your health, these types of things like biofeedback and neurofeedback, along with that, breathing and focused breathing. I can tell you, I have special operations and they are always like, I don't understand. What do you mean? Like public safety agencies don't do like breath work training. Like it blows their minds.
Yeah.
It's so important.
Yeah. That's something that I feel like the military has learned as they prep, as they get ready for missions. And it should be something that in the first responder space that we are utilizing to even en route to a critical call. It's something simple and easy that we can do. And it doesn't have to be every call. It could even be at the start of shift to set you up in a good space. And then on the flip side of it as well, I mean, it just goes back to basically letting our brain do what it needs to do, not short circuit it. Tell me about this. So this is something that I heard about recently with PTSI or PTSD. I believe there was a study done on Vietnam vets versus, can't remember the specific prisoners of war, but essentially Vietnam vets, there was a lot of PTSD. And in comparison, these POWs that had been prisoners for years, a large majority of them didn't end up coming back with the same type of injury. And they determined that one of the big reasons for that was purpose. And the POWs, a lot of them expressed that they had this purpose for getting home, whatever it was for them. And that just didn't exist for some of the Vietnam vets. Can you speak to that? Does that sound accurate?
Yes. 100%. I worked pretty extensively with Vietnam combat vets, and there's a few, and this is just based off my anecdotal experience, not any research that I did, but there's a lot of circumstantial, contextual factors that I think play into why a lot of, I should say, Vietnam combat veterans really suffered in the aftermath of coming back. Obviously, war, killing, these things, you know.
Totally. Like,
but there were a couple different things. One, the purpose part. So when we feel like we're doing something, but we don't understand or we don't believe in what we're doing, guess what that breeds? Guess what that's a breeding ground for?
Yeah, moral injury. Yeah.
So much moral injury in the Vietnam veterans that I've worked with. It's astounding. So there's that plays into that. So when we're doing something that we feel, because I mean, also a lot of them were drafted in. This wasn't a war that many of them were like, I want to be here. There were also a lot of circumstances with that war that, you know, I've worked with a lot of combat vets that did actually engage in some wrongdoing over there. I mean, outside of what they were ordered to do. Because of just the lack of sleep deprivation, the constant threat, you know, opiums, all these different things going on. And why am I even here? I shouldn't even be here. This war shouldn't even be going on. That there was a lot of like disconnect from like who they were as a person. They engaged in things. They came back and 30 years later, 40 years later, they're still like just really suffering from post-traumatic stress and moral injury. So I would completely agree with that as lack of purpose. And the third one would be that, you know, when people in World War II came back, yay, oh my God, our heroes. They'd get literally spat on when they came back. So imagine getting drafted to go to a war that you don't even want to be in, that you don't believe should even be happening, or you don't even see the purpose of. You're having to do things, really bad things that you're ordered to do as well. And then you come back and people think you're a piece of crap because of your service. So all these things, I think, uniquely play into the Vietnam combat, the Vietnam veteran era, that really put their risk of post-traumatic stress and moral injury a lot higher.
Yeah. So how we then relate that to first responders is understand what you're getting yourself into, believe in what you're getting yourself into. You should have a good understanding coming into public safety, whether you're a police officer, firefighter, paramedic, or even going into the military, having some purpose behind that. But then on the back end of that, don't let the military, the fire service, or whatever you're doing be your entire life. You have to set yourself up for success because, yeah, I can't speak for military, but as a fire organization, and I love my department is phenomenal, but it is an organization. It is something that is going to keep moving whether I am there or not. And so I'm trying to let people know very proactively that you have to look out for yourself. You have to take care of yourself in the sense that family and what you do outside of work needs to be a lot more of you than what the fire department is. And the fire department is very good, I would assume, just like the military, of creating this pride. I mean, it is a brotherhood and you should have pride in what you're doing, but they're very good at making that seem like that should be the number one priority. And I'm not saying that all departments are maliciously doing that or specifically trying to make you think that way. That's just how it gets talked about. And that's the drive. So make sure, being proactive for new people, that you don't let the fire service or whatever public service that you're in become your number one, especially when you're young, you don't have a spouse, you don't have kids yet. Don't let it be your everything then, because it's going to be harder to transition later on when those things do come. And I think a number of people could speak to that. Okay. Thanks. That's not because I got it right off the get-go. So I've had to learn over time. We are going to switch gears a little bit. That was pretty heavy in trauma, but it was awesome. And I kind of rabbit trailed a few times there, but that's okay. Let's get into peer support side of things.
Okay.
Peer support, they're awesome and sometimes awful. Why?
Well, a lot of different reasons. Okay. Again, this is just what I see sometimes. Sometimes they're awful because they're put together very hastily or in a way that is, you know, not actually building it with a strong foundation. Sometimes I hear, I work with departments or work with people that they're like, we have a peer support team, just, you know, a few of us, like, you know, are the people that people go to, or like our chief said thumbs up to have a peer support team. So we just, like, you know, saw who wanted to have it and who wanted to be a peer supporter. And then, you know, we kind of went forward with it. Developing a strong, effective, and highly utilized, by the way, that's the other important part, is like, do people actually utilize the peer support team? It takes a lot of different layers. So I think the most common thing that I see as to why peer support teams aren't as effective is because, you know, they didn't have all the parts leading into it of, like, you know, you start off writing like a SOP, you know, SOG, like standard operating procedures, which highlight everything that your department follows, you know, how to recruit these peer supports, what trainings are necessary. Maybe some of them don't actually even get the trainings. There's not ongoing supervision or things like that are going on. And they tend to just fizzle, or I can't tell you how many times I'm at a department or working with people that they're like, yeah, we have a peer support team, I think, but I have no idea how to reach them. I don't know who they are. Like, I'm not exactly sure. If the other people in the department don't know how to go about doing that, reaching out for help is already a tough thing. Reaching out for support can already be a tough thing. If they don't know what number to call or how to do it, people are going to be like, hey, can someone point me in the direction of where to do this or how to do this? And it just doesn't happen. So I'd say those are probably the most prominent things that I see.
Yeah. So necessary, because that resource is needed. It's needed to bridge gaps. It's needed to make sure that there is safe space for people. It's awesome because they work. They've been shown to work. They do a really good job when they're effective and they're supported correctly by administration and people are fully aware that they exist.
Mm-hmm. And they're trained properly, right? And that means
trained,
like,
properly.
And here's the other thing too, is like, part of that, like implementing a peer support program is, I always, when I'm building peer support programs and training, is like making it a normal part of the department and culture, meaning it's not like we just use peer support when there's something bad, you know, or I only go to talk to, like, this is proactive. Peer support is like the good things, the bad things, and everything in between, right? That it becomes more infiltrated into the culture of the department, as opposed to, you just send them out, you know, after a bad critical incident or when someone's really not doing well. You know, you need that too, but that shouldn't just be the only thing that it's utilized for.
Yeah. So tell me, a really good peer support team that you've seen, when they plug themselves into good things, because you said don't always do it in the bad, what does that look like? How are they plugging themselves into some of the good things?
You could call someone if they come across them in person, shoot them a text. Hey, man, you know, congrats on that promotion. Or, I heard it was your daughter's birthday the other day. How have you been doing? Are you guys doing anything fun for her birthday? Or, but, you know, just like literally just building relationships. And, you know, a lot of people in the fire service, because of the cohesion, they always have those great relationships, but like doing it from a perspective and intentionally trying to reach out and provide support, even if it's just, hey, I heard something good's happening, or, you know, how are you doing with that? I just wanted to check in on this. It's important to do that, not only because it just continued support, like having cohesion and continued support is great for everyone. But I've also seen an impediment to people utilizing peer support is, oh my God, people are going to know I'm not doing well. You know, like, so if they know I'm contacting Jesse, people are going to know I'm not doing well. So I'm not going to do that because I don't want people to know something's not going well.
That's good. That makes a lot of sense. So 100%, just building relationships, man, that applies in so many things. I was just telling my probie this the other day for a totally different reason, but when we do patient care as a paramedic or as an EMT, some of the best patient care that I've ever seen from people is the ones who know how to have conversations with people, because usually it just flows well. It's normal conversation. People end up telling you way more, and you usually get to the root problem a lot faster. So yeah, just talking to people, building relationships. So the simplest practical tool, just talking. Best way to be in peer support, talking, building relationships on a regular basis. So kind of some crossover there. Real talk segment, maybe a fun little game for you. You're in red flag, green flag. Okay. and why. So I'm going to throw out a few phrases. I want you to red flag them or green flag them. You just need to get over it, bro. Okay, why?
Well, a couple of different things. One, very invalidating for someone who maybe is struggling with something, which then that person is just going to be like, there's something wrong with me. You're right. I should just get over it. I'm just going to suck it in and never reach out to someone again. I would say that's my immediate reason for the red flag, is just getting over it.
Okay. How would that sound different? So let me reframe this too. At certain points, there's times where tough love or, you know, keeping somebody moving can be very effective. How might that be rephrased to sound better coming from a peer support?
Okay. All right. I'm trying to think of an example. Like, can you think of an example of like where the get up, what were they needing to get over?
So let's take my personal situation. Okay. So I did not have that. I had a friend that after I had been dealing with this for a year and had been working through it, who had been very supportive. Instead of saying it's time to just get over it, he told me at some point we all have to make some choices. For me, that was beneficial and effective on potentially staying stuck in what I was doing with dwelling on a certain topic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe something along those lines, if yeah, we could rephrase it.
So just get over it, again, would be, it's just not going to be effective for someone for a lot of different reasons and would likely just, you know, cause, you know, more issues in the long term. But in this example, it could be something like, listen, man, you know, I've seen you, you've been stuck in this for quite some time now. And I'm wondering, you know, what could be the best way for you to move forward? Cause I don't want to still, you know, at some point, you know, you got to make a decision and move forward from this. So what could that look like? Or, you know, something like that, because it's still validating. I'd be like, just get over it. And it's practical too. To your point, you're validating doesn't mean agreement, by the way. I like to tell all my peer supporters and first responders this. Validating does not mean I agree with what you're saying. It's just saying, I see that you're stuck. I see this is really bothering you and it's been bothering you for a long time. I don't want you to be stuck anymore. Maybe it's time to think about some other options.
A simple way to sum up what you're saying, taking something as invalidating, still validate it, which like you said, does not mean agreeing with them or what they're doing, or but validating, acknowledging it and approaching that differently. Like for me with my circumstance, my buddy is like, I could tell you've been working hard on this. I can tell you've been doing these things. I know that this is challenging. I don't want to see you in this same space this time next year. And for me, it was like light bulb moment, because he did validate what I have been experiencing. He validated that it was challenging and tough, but also was like, how do we make that next step? What do we do?
Exactly. Right. But if he had approached you being like, just get over it, probably wouldn't have been as productive for you. Right. Even if there's something again, validation does not mean agreement. It doesn't mean like we always have to be like, oh, I'm so sorry. That's not what validation means. It just means like objectively pointing out like what's actually like where that person is at that time. So even if we have a friend, let's say that just keeps messing, like they just keep cheating on their girlfriend. Validating doesn't mean like, yeah, man, like that. It just means like, hey, I see you, like you're clearly not doing that well. You're doing something over and over again that you know is wrong. And then it's making you feel bad. And it's just leading to all this other stuff. So obviously I can see that you're not in a really good place right now. So right, that would even be validating instead of just being like, stop doing that shit, man. What's wrong with you? Right?
Yeah.
So I mean, like that's yeah, kind of a, you know, just kind of being like, it could still be tough love, but it's like, obviously there's something going on with you. You're not doing well. Otherwise you wouldn't keep doing the same shit over and over again.
Right. Okay. Next one. Let's go grab a beer and talk it out. Red flag, green flag.
Red flag sometimes, green flag other times. And here's what I say about this. Red flag is if this is the only thing that someone does, like this is my go-to to decompress, is like, it's one of my top go-tos is I just go drink, right? Even if it's not with a friend, if it's, I go home and this is how I kind of calm down. When it starts to become that this is the only way that I have to deal with this, not great. But I'm a big proponent of this because I think it helps people talk and process. Again, not when it's all the time, just like anything, scales being balanced. But I say this all the time, like when I do debriefings at like critical incident debriefings, you'll see some clinicians be like, okay, how to cope? Don't drink alcohol. Don't do this. Don't do that. I don't agree with that, right? Because if going to have a couple of beers with a couple of friends you know, afterwards allows you to just decompress a little bit and talk about some of this stuff and bond, and then you go home, that can be a very helpful thing to do. So now if you go and have 9 beers so that you just pass out a night, again, not good. So it can be,
'cause then you're not even going to remember that you talked about those things.
Exactly. Yeah. Red flags sometimes, depending on the context, but also can be a green flag.
Yeah. I mean, I'm no expert, so I can't even sit here and be like, oh, yeah, I agree. Because I do agree. And I like it because it doesn't seem black and white. It can be very beneficial. It's as simple as it's ways to make that conversation happen. You know, a lot of times, even how we use dark humor in the fire service, it's a way to decompress or open the stage for more free flow conversation.
I've literally done research on gallows humor in the fire service, and there's other research on it too. And it is overall a net positive. And again, just like anything else, when it becomes an avoidance behavior of like, I don't ever touch my thoughts or feelings with a 10-foot pole. So I just make everything a joke all the time, whether I'm at the fire station or I'm at home and all that. Not good. But on an average, it's a net positive because it is useful, it is helpful, and it does have utility.
Okay, last one. Let's bring it to the chief.
These are tough ones because there's just so much. I mean, what's the context? You know, I mean, it could... That would be, you know, the first one was a clear red flag to me. This one, the last one and this one, it depends on the context. How is the chief? Like, how is leadership? What's the morale in that department? What is going on there?
Okay. Let me frame it then for you.
Okay.
Let's say that we have a department that has a good peer support program. We have a chief that is well-liked, one that seems to listen and does not immediately react to things. Yeah, let's go with that.
That's good. That would make it more possible in the green. But I guess, you know, depending on what it is that this person wants to take to the chief, how quickly they're taking it to the chief and why they're taking it to the chief, it depends, right? If there's, let's use peer support programming for an example, right? Like there's a lot of people really wanting a peer support program. There's, you know, some captains I've been meeting and putting some of this together and thinking about how it might be done. And then they're like, let's take it to the chief and see what he thinks. And if this is something he's willing to put the thumbs up on so we can get this rolling, great. But if it's like a conflict or something like that, and there hasn't really been an attempt to try and mediate or, you know, try and resolve this down here, and it's like, let's just immediately go to the chief, you know, I don't know.
Okay. So, and that's tough. Like you said, there's so many options with that question. It's loaded, but I think ultimately what you are saying in that is that let's take it to the chief. Unfortunately, has to be the answer sometimes, depending on the situation. And depending on the chief, that could be more or less scary. But this probably should not be the first phrase out of your mouth when somebody comes to you as a peer support person.
No.
That person is simply wanting to be heard. And so that is, as a peer support, we need to hear them first and foremost. We need to make sure that they're in a safe place first. Then we have to go through appropriate channels and think about what really needs to happen with this. And that can be tough as a peer support person, because you might have a relatively new firefighter who is on the peer support team. You might have senior captains who are on peer support team and might not know the best steps to take. Or if they're waiting in gray area of like, I don't know, did this person really mess up? And I also might be in a world of hurt if I don't say something. And I guess what I would say, what I've seen, tell me if you agree with this, is that number one priority, make sure the person's safe. Hear them out. And that is what they need first and foremost. We want to make sure that they're safe. We want to be there for them. And yes, the first response should not be about your department. It should be about them. People first. And then if it is something that feels completely out of your expertise and you don't know what to do, then you can start by saying, I would like to bring another peer support person in on this that understands what we're dealing with a little bit better. Would you be okay with that? And then that person then obviously can help Wade that a little bit more. And there are times where if somebody comes to you, this can be tough, but the reality is if somebody screwed up and messed up, at least they're coming to you and they can make change if they're coming to you to talk about it. But if something is criminal or goes against what the department has set for its rules and regulations, there is a point where we have to go to the chief with certain things.
I would agree with all that. I didn't know you were asking in the context of like someone asking, going to a peer supporter and the peer supporter saying, let's go to the chief. Yes, I would agree with all that. I think that most cases, it's not a good idea to just respond with, let's go to the chief. I think, but that there are some cases, you know, like you're saying, mostly, and those are fewer and far between, but yeah, in most cases it would be the person first and trying to, even if you run into a wall and you're like, I'm not really sure what to do about this, is trying to, with their consent, you know, bring other people in and, you know, before going straight to the chief. Yeah.
Yeah. Very rarely. I mean, I kind of gave the full spectrum there, but I should say, at least from my experience in my departments or other departments I've been involved with, it is very rare that you ever have to take it to that level. But if one person says things like that, that right off the get-go, it is going to be a very ineffective peer support program because people aren't going to feel safe coming forward with anything. And that's why, on the flip side of all of this, probably a good idea that admin is not involved in peer support because they're not peers. They're not doing the same things.
I would agree with you.
Okay. Sorry. That one was a curveball and didn't provide a lot of context, but I think we got where we needed to go with that.
I think so.
Okay. Let's shift to culture and communication, saying the hard stuff. So you wrote another one of your articles about having hard conversations. Okay. Our first responders probably uniquely bad at this.
I think because of a culture that we can't say that anything's wrong. And so I think not only does that put us in a position not to get the support and info and the things we need so that we can prevent ourselves from snowballing, but it also, what I find a lot, which is why I wrote that article for Crackle, is that, you know, there's also this very common thread of, I hear my first responders saying like, I didn't want to approach them about that because I didn't know what to say. I don't know how to fix it. And what if I screw it up and it makes them worse? So I'm just not going to say anything at all. So this idea of like, I need to know exactly how to fix it. I need to know exactly what to do. I need to know exactly how to say it. And also I'm afraid I'm going to make them worse. So I'm just not going to say anything at all.
Biggest myth about being mentally tough.
That it means you're completely infallible. Nothing's ever going to bother you ever. Normal things, like I always call it like normal reactions to abnormal events, like, you know, being affected by a tough call, whatever the call was, well, even if you wouldn't consider it a tough call, right? Being affected by something doesn't mean that that's abnormal. These are normal reactions to abnormal events, for example. So yeah, the biggest myth would be I'm infallible. Yeah. Nothing should be bothering.
Okay. Yeah. Resilience, that's a buzzword, but when we started talking about it here within our department, between me and the peer support lead, one of the things that we came out of with that was, I feel like a lot of times we talk about resilience in the sense of always having to bounce back or always being just this rock, like you said, just unfallible. And it really should be a combination of the two, that we be proactive so that we can stand strong when we're prepared and able to, because that's great. Like if truly you are able to deal with something and process it in a good, a healthy way and move past it healthy, great. We want that. That is how it should work. That's not always going to happen. For whatever reason, everybody's different with that. We can't say this one call is going to affect everybody. It's different for everybody. So being strong when you need to, and then having the tools to recover and bounce back when we need as well.
Right. Two parts, like you're saying, the front end and the back end of resilience, right? Resilience doesn't mean that nothing ever affects me and everything just bounces off of me and I'm good. I'm going to compare it again to an athlete, for like a high-end elite professional athlete. They're constantly doing things to build their physical resilience and mental, by the way. We'll just keep it to physical resilience to prevent injury or every professional athlete you've ever known in your life is going to have had injuries at some point, or when they do get the injury, they're able to recover from that injury better because they have been doing all these other things in place. That's more of the bounce back. But there's another part to this, and you kind of alluded to it too. It's not always that we bounce back to exactly where we were before, but sometimes there's adaptation and growth too, and that's resilience. So in my first responder military communities, I sometimes at the forefront of therapy here, I just want to go back to how I was before. None of this shit bothered me. I just want to go back to that. Then as we start working together, they actually grow in ways that they're like, I don't want to go back to doing what I was doing and just holding things in and doing this and not understanding what was going on with me. Now I have new insight. I have better relationships with my wife, my kids, and all these different things. So that is also resilience. It's not always bouncing back exactly to where we were before, but actually adapting in a way that's more conducive to the quality of life that we want.
Yeah, I like that. Adaption for that. I have heard that before. There's people that don't want to feel, don't want to like have those things because it's scary to them. But when we train people on this and when we get people to see the other side of it, they love it typically because they see how much better it can be. Because once again, the communication, the just talking becomes a lot more normal. Communication with spouse, family, everybody gets better. If you could make one rule every firehouse had to follow for better communication, what would it be?
If I could make one rule that every firehouse had to follow for better communication, that's a good question. I would say if you're noticing something in yourself, share it, you know, with respect. I mean, you have to share your deepest, darkest secrets. But if you're noticing something, you know, or if you're noticing someone else that is kind of, you think might be dealing with something that you've experienced, is to basically relate, I guess, is what I'm trying to get to. Like relate, whether it be something that you're going on, you know, something's going on with you and you want to be like, you know, I haven't slept well the last couple of nights, or, you know, you see that someone else is kind of shaking up after a call and you're like, I'm, you know, hey, I know what that's like. I, you know, I've had that many times, but it's just to kind of like put that branch out and relate so that, you know, continue to build those relationships with that communication. It really comes down to being able to people understanding that they're not alone in what they're experiencing and that there's not just these silos of silence going on all
the time. Yeah. And that's a top down. As you become a leader in the fire service, as you've seen that be successful, that really needs to be openly communicated to some of the younger generations as well, that this is something that is safe and okay to do. So encourage captains, leadership at the line level to share those things, to be open about them, lead, right? Do those things that actually allow your crew to feel safe and supported in that. Okay. This is kind of a bonus question. If, as a therapist, you were to design a fire station, how would you design a fire station?
What do you mean design?
I don't know. You tell me. What would it be, with your experience of seeing fire stations and how they're designed, and you've probably seen quite a few of them, would there be any better way to set them up in your mind?
Gosh, this is a tough question. This is a hard one to just, all right, I'm thinking of a couple different things. One, fitness, you know, having some type of dedicated space for fitness and physical health to allow people to do that. Two, I'm thinking about sleeping arrangements and the promotion of, like, where individuals sleep, you know, promoting the best sleep possible. I'm also thinking of other like logistical factors, you know, like if there's certain things that we can do, like the, you know, the alarm sounding, things like that. So like if not everyone has to get up at that time, or if there's certain, you know, there's so many other like logistical factors there too, which that can then promote better sleep in the long term as well. So I would definitely take those things into consideration.
See, and you mentioned nothing about a couch for anybody to lay down and lay out all their feelings for you.
No, I did not. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So it's funny because I think what you are saying is that we need all these spaces to make sure that we're maintaining overall wellness. That can be challenging for some departments, but try and do the best one step at a time. Fitness, grow those areas as best as you can. Rooms that allow for sleep. We just got the brick system here that does allow for individual unit alerting, softer wake-ups and whatnot.
That's awesome.
What about saunas, cold plunges at every station?
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay. I mean, things. You know, I know there's things that you can enjoy doing there too. I know pickleballs, like there's a lot of departments that are like, can't do that on site, you know, but I know a couple that have pickleball courts on there. But here's the thing that I like to tell leadership, or like when I'm meeting with chiefs, is that yes, it's important to have like competent therapists that people can go to. Of course. But like mental health is like, it's the whole thing, because if there's certain things in like built into the structure of the department where people are just getting woken up all the time, they can't, you know, sleep, they wake up 15 times throughout the night doing this, or this is uncomfortable, or they don't have access to this, or they don't have access to like a good cooking space, so they eat like shit all the time when they're on shift, they're going to feel worse emotionally, like all of that.
Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah, it all matters. It's a lot. That was a loaded question, but you handled it well.
I'll send you a blueprint, a design, you know, a blueprint at another time. So
yeah. The other thing I would add in, right? Like, we obviously have to have that individual space for people to sleep. And we want that to obviously be quiet space, a space that we can darken down so that we can get the best sleep possible. But outside of that, I would also suggest that as much open space as possible for that family space, for
community,
for you to interact and communicate.
Yeah.
As you already talked about.
That community, like building a floor plan, so it also promotes community for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Because what we don't want is isolation. We don't want people to close off. So we need to have that environment that allows for that. Obviously, we talked about, you got to have a fitness space, you got to have these things, but people aren't going and hiding in those spaces, right? They're doing stuff. There's a purpose for those places. And if your fitness space can also be inclusive of having everybody work out at the same time, or, you know, the pickleball court or whatever, those are all things that, you know, foster that community. So, okay, let's wrap up here. This is going to be a speed round, and don't take offense to this. We're going to use the term shrink approved or just sauce. Okay. So shrink approved is helpful and healthy. Okay. Just sauce is nonsense or do not recommend. Okay. All right. Crying in your car after a shift.
Shrink approved.
Okay. Meditation apps you never open.
I guess sauce. So what's the point? Yeah.
Yeah. Is there meditation apps that you would suggest that are very beneficial?
I like to use the couple that are were created by the Department of Defense. They're free. One of them is called COVID Coach, which I hate the name of it because it just came out during that time, but it doesn't really have anything to do with it. But they have like all the basic like PMR, like guided imagery, all the stuff that I like to do on there. So I use that one. It's very basic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Peer supporters who ghost their own therapist.
That sucks. Sucks. Right? Don't ghost your therapist. It sucks. Just say why you don't want, you know what I'm saying? Don't do it.
Yeah. Practice what you preach.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Burnout memes.
Shrink approved.
Okay. Retreats with cold plunges and goat yoga.
I mean, this is not something I've done myself, but I suppose that sounds cool. Sure. Why not?
Okay. Telling a probie we don't talk about our feelings here.
That sucks. Okay. That's
us.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, Brooke, I hope that was fun for you. I love talking with you. It's always really good conversation. You are good with humor. You are very blunt with what you say. And I think it is all extremely valuable. And I'm super excited that you are in the Treasure Valley area now. But that being said, I just saw a map the other day that you posted that you are pretty much everywhere. Like, you pretty much serve every state except for my home state of Montana, I think.
Yeah, hopefully your home state of Montana gets in the side pack. But yeah, now I'm approved to provide therapy to first responders in 42 states, which is pretty awesome.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So cool. So anyone listening, I encourage you to take advantage of what Brooke is offering, reach out to her, see what you can get through your department, and just find ways to work with her, read the stuff that she has out there, the articles, which are all on the Center Trauma, CTAS, yeah?
CenterTAS.com, CenterTAS.com.
So all those things are there on that website. Listen to her podcast. Look at the articles that you've written. What else? Is there other ways you want people to be able to reach out to you, social media, email you if they've got questions?
Yeah, I mean, my social media is Dr. Brooke PhD with doctor spelled out. So you can find me there. And, you know, I post about certain things that I'm going to be doing or just sometimes just little tidbits. But yeah, you're more than welcome to reach out to me too if you want to check out my website, centertas.com. But yeah, don't be a stranger. Feel free to reach out.
Okay. Last thing. Do you have a final mic drop message for anyone who might be struggling in silence?
Mental health is physical health. So, you know, there's a lot of things that can be done. You're not permanently like this. There's not something permanently wrong with you.
Well, thank you so much, Brooke. I think we're going to have a part two with you because we didn't even really get into burnout stuff. And I know that there's a whole lot there. You've done a lot. You truly are an expert in this field and very thankful for your time.
Thank you for having me on, Jesse. Happy to come on again anytime.
That's it for this episode of the Forging Wellness Podcast. If you found value in today's conversation, please subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who could benefit. Your support keeps this mission going. Want to help us grow? Consider making a donation. Every bit helps us bring more impactful content your way. Follow us on Instagram at ForgingWellness208 and check us out on YouTube. Thanks for being a part of the journey. Keep forging your wellness, and we'll see you next time.